Well, now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, so let's offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Dylan.
Let's see if that works. Hi, I'm Dylan, not Dylan, and I'm an alcoholic. It's nice to be here, and it's much nicer to be sitting in that seat. So I'll just tell my story. My husband told me on my way over that he said that people who prepare do really well at this. And I thought that was a really good time to tell me on the drive over. Yeah, it was nice of him to mention that, like two blocks away. So I said, oh, I didn't prepare at all. I'm just going to pray. And he's like, yeah, that's not been as successful. So he's a motivational interviewer, you know, he's a good motivational speaker. All right, so let's start with my story. My alcohol use began when I was a child, like a very young child. I loved alcohol. I don't know how old I was when I discovered it, but I was barely walking. And in my house, there were two sides. There was the alcohol side and then my mom's side. And my mom's side is she was like the non-fun, non-alcohol loving, real rulesy. That was my perception. I didn't want to be on her side. I liked my dad. My dad is a tall, good-looking, charismatic cowboy. And he drank. And he drank a lot. And he took me most places with him. I started going to bars at a young age. I started bartending for him and his friends. That was cute. And I'd always, you know, there's a tax for delivery. And it's me drinking your drink, you know. So I started passing out at a very young age, like elementary school. I thought that was just going to sleep, you know. I suffered from a lot of headaches as a child. And I didn't know that that had anything to do with alcohol. And so my father left my house. I don't know if it was voluntarily, but he's been married 5 times. And I guess not everybody's a big fan of him like me. So anyways, he left the house and he took the booze with him. And so now mom was really ruling the no alcohol zone. And so I didn't participate in any of that nonsense. I went out. You know, my perception has changed, but I'll tell you what my perception was then. My perception was is that I got the raw end of the deal. I came into this world thinking that life had already screwed me. I don't know how or why I have that, had that attitude, but that was fully my belief system. I felt like I was a victim, and I gave you lots of reasons, you know, why I felt that way, and I felt very misunderstood. I felt like, you know, I saw these families and their parents, I don't know, didn't beat each other up, and they seemed to have money, and they both lived in the same house, and I always wanted something I didn't have, always, and that started at a real young age. And so the no alcohol thing didn't work for me, because it's really one of the only times in my childhood that, you know, I felt good. So I didn't know. I mean, I love this program. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is where I've grown up, and I've been sober. I'll be sober 5 years on December 4th. Thank you. So I'm just like the most immature person ever. And this fellowship has just raised me, and it's given me this language to which I can describe, you know, I can describe myself. So for, you know, for the newcomer who thinks, oh, you know, who, if you feel like you don't have it figured out, you will. If you work a thorough set of 12 steps and you keep coming back and you work with a sponsor, you will develop the language which you can express yourself and your disease. And so, you know, that's how I got all that. Everything I'm about to share, I've stolen from somebody else. So, yeah. So I was basically born irritable and discontent. And I was a problem child right away. The teacher, like in kindergarten, said, you know, she has a problem. She only wants to do what she wants to do. And she doesn't play well with others if it's not what she doesn't want to do. And she will just walk out of the classroom. And, you know, and I would walk home. I would be like, I'm out, you know. So this isn't going my way. I'm done. And I didn't think that was a problem. I thought that was just part of my entitlement issues. And so needless to say, I got asked to leave a lot of schools. And this is like in the town of Lindsay. There's not a lot of schools, you know. So I think by the time I was in fifth grade, we had come to the conclusion, and I say we, they just usually kept me in the chair while they discussed me, that I was no longer suitable for their school system because of my behavioral issues, you know, flipping people off and, you know, walking out of classes and, you know, with a speech. I like to leave a parting speech and tell everybody how wrong they were. So they stuck me in a Christian school. I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying I didn't thrive. So they added more discipline, more rules, and I couldn't follow any of those. And again, I don't know. They just always seemed surprised that I'd leave. And I just wasn't willing to participate in anything. And I remember there was corporal punishment. You know, and I was stupid. I was like dumb because I was doing stuff and I was going to get a spanking from like the preacher, the principal. You know, and I'm a smart ass. So I like tell them, oh yeah, pervert, I'm sure you want to spank me. You know, I'm like in seventh grade, sixth grade. So he won't. He doesn't spank me. And my mother comes down to do it and she thoroughly beats the hell out of me. And I realized then I had made a tragic error, tragic mistake. I should have let him just, you know, he probably would have been a lot easier. So they asked me to leave that school and I went back to, Lindsay had forgotten about me. I was welcomed back. Mostly because I was tall and they'd hoped I'd play sports. And this is the story of my life. I tried. And when I say I tried, I mean, I tried to participate. To me, I always felt like I'm trying. They're always asking me, why aren't you doing this? Why don't you do this? And I'm like in my head, like, what the hell's wrong with these people? I couldn't possibly put more effort into my life than I am right now. That's how I felt. So, you know, needless to say, I didn't play because, you know, you have to attend and not take other substances. So, you know, which I learned if you mix those with alcohol, that worked really well for me. You know, I thought. And I landed in my first rehab at the age of 15. Yeah. And I always, you know, I did not go in like humbly and, you know, I didn't come out with like, oh, well, look, I've learned a valuable lesson. I'm just a big fat liar. And so what happened was, is that it was a nice break from Lindsay. I was up in Fresno and my insurance ran out after 60 days. So it's not like I graduated, but they did kick me out finally. And I did try to not use. I didn't know about this allergic reaction. I didn't understand. I really thought. I believed at that age that I could stop. So I really did try to stay stopped. And what happened is they weren't giving me any of the respect I thought I deserved. You know, and it felt like I'd been sober a long time. Upon reflection, it was probably 60 days at the most. But it felt like a really long time. And I felt like it really wasn't all it was cracked up to be because I really felt like everybody should be kissing my ass at that point and patting me on the back, and they really weren't doing that. So I didn't really see the perks, you know. I went to this treatment center. Nobody ever told me about the 12 steps or any of that. I think they just wanted me to stop, you know, being a problem. But I went out. I remember, though, that I was invited to speak at Steve Garvey Junior High, for those of you who are my age. You know who he is. For the young people, he's a baseball player. And they named this junior high after him in Lindsay. And they asked him to come speak, and they asked me to come speak. Now, I don't know what BS I was selling, you know, but I got up there and sold it with the best of them. I mean, you know, I was like there to help people with my 40 days sober, my whole new perspective, with absolutely not a solution. I do remember, and there's only things like these things happen now that I'm sober and kind of an adult. I look back and I go, oh God, that's embarrassing. Now that I remember it the way it really happened. And so I couldn't figure out why Steve Garvey wasn't like recognizing my importance. And I guess he felt the same way. And I was just like, who is he, Mr. Professional Baseball Player? You know, I'm 15 and I'm rocking this town, you know? And I like gave him a hard time because he was shorter than me. And I'm a little bit of a bee, apparently. Like, I made him like, you know, like I posed like where I really loomed over him. You know what I mean? Just, that's the kind of person I was. And I could never figure out why people reacted unkindly to me. I'd be like, God, did you see what a jerk he was being? I did nothing wrong. Meanwhile, I was always doing just this really foul stuff, real sneaky foul stuff to people, trying to make them feel bad. And I don't, you know, that's just who I was. That's just my personality. That's just how I went through life. So needless to say, I didn't stay sober. I don't know. I guess because I was early in my disease, I was able to, you know, pull it together when I had kids. And I say when I had them, while I was pregnant with them. Like, not like when they were, you know, my kids are 29 and 25, and they could tell you some stories. Mostly they just look at me and just say, I'm so glad you're sober these days, you know, and I get it, you know, because I made a pretty bad impression on them. They're just like, oh God, the way you used to drive around with us, you know, falling asleep. And I did tell them, you know, my solution for that was I turned them into like my designated drivers at the age of 14. I mean, I was just like, yeah, you know, you're right. I shouldn't be drinking and driving. And plus, you're turning into a nag. So, you know, my solution is I'm going to put you to work. And I share that, and it is funny, but the sad part is that I drug those kids through my disease, you know, from the moment they were born. And they really did get the short end of the stick, you know. I didn't just use alcohol as a solution. I had a lot of expectations on everybody around me. And one of my other favorite solutions, and it happened to go really well with alcohol, was men. I loved using men as a solution. Men were very replaceable in my life. I always had the idea that I was going to get settled down, meet the guy, meet the right one. And by the way, the right one was always about 20 to 30 years older than me with a big fat account. And I couldn't figure out why people called me a gold digger. This is me in my 20s. Like, what? You know, I was just, it's part of that, like, I always felt very misunderstood, because I was just like, I don't understand. We have a connection. And I really believed my own crap, you know, so the problem is, what would interrupt our connection with me and Mr. Man of the Year is that, see, the idea of me is always better than the reality of me. So they meet me and they're like, oh my God, this is, you know, fun, young, blonde, you know, not, and this is, you know, and she's so much fun, right? And I guess they thought there was an off switch. Or like, and see, this is the part, like, I never understood this. Other people went home and stopped doing the stuff that I was always doing. And so I guess these people in my life that I had developed relationships with expected me to do that, like, just stop and start participating in a normal life. And, you know, if it was occasionally, I'm going to say probably maybe 10 times, I did attempt to do that. I thought, this guy's, you know, this is the solution right here. And me and my kids are going to live happily ever after. And it's always like, you've got to stop drinking. You know, I can't take it anymore. You know, you have to stop. And I'm like, all right, if that's the rule, then I will. And I would. That would be my big supreme sacrifice and gift to them. I'm going to stop drinking. And again, it was one of those things where it felt like forever. Felt like I was really doing the deal. And the problem is, and like I said, I didn't have any understanding of this disease. You know, I could stop, but I couldn't stay stopped. And when I wasn't drinking, I would think about, you know, again, I'm getting screwed. I need to go drink. It would always turn into this. I can tell you how it ended all 10 times. I start sneaking out because I really think that I can do that. I think I can hide the fact that I'm a big old drunk. You know, I don't even recognize that quality in myself. And I think, well, I'm going to start drinking. I'm not going to tell them about it. And I start drinking, and of course, you know, immediately, like by week one, really, by Friday night, who am I kidding? I come home in a blackout with a speech telling him he's a big a-hole for putting these rules on me, and he's controlling, and he needs to leave. If he wants me to follow these rules, you know, I completely flip it. And like, you know, maybe we last for like, I don't know, a week to a month, but eventually I can't take the looks, because that's the other thing. I'm going to completely treat you like crap. I'm going to be really, really bad to you, and I'm going to do everything I want to do. Oh, and you can't have a reaction. If you react and you give me a look or, oh my God, say something to me about it, that's the worst, I will torture you for that. And when I'm done torturing you, which, by the way, is me thinking I'm being very tolerant, I admit now that I tortured people. When I'm done torturing you, you will come home and find all of your stuff on the lawn. And no, it doesn't stop there. And I will tell everybody what a bad person you are. So it's not just that you lost me. Now you can't go to the places that you used to go because, you know, those people have never lived with me. So they believe me. And I'm really good at assassinating you. And like, so now, and because I believe it, I really thought I got the short end of the stick every single time. So like, you know, when I'm telling them, oh yeah, no, he's controlling, you know, I believed it. You know, no, I never told him the truth. You know, he wants me to come home and go to bed at a reasonable hour. He wants me to show up for the kids' Little League games. I did not tell them that. I told him things like, he calls me names. Well, he did. He called me drunk, you know, and I was offended. I was like, well, who the hell are you talking to me like that? Don't you know who I am? Oh, that was my big attitude. You know, don't you know who I am? So anyway, needless to say, I didn't do really well with relationships. I was married once for 2 years, and we parted ways. And then I got engaged a lot. Like because I liked the idea of falling in love, I got engaged a lot. But alcohol always took that away from me. I could never, you know, even in Vegas, I didn't show up for the wedding. I'm across the street, true story, getting drunk at the tequila bar, and now I come back with an attitude. And I'm like, listen, don't you be talking about this all the way home. That was my kid's father. I was like, I don't want to be hearing your bad attitude for 6 hours. You know, another relationship, I leave to go to the bathroom during a show. We're at a dinner show. And I forgot to come back for a couple days. And I finally found the room and the hotel and all that. And I was just, again, like, please don't ruin our trip with your bad attitude. You know, don't you be talking about all this. And, you know, and I'd call my friends and I'd be like, yeah, he's being such a jerk. I don't know why. Just, you know, I always made sure I had a good audience around to support me so that they agreed. I didn't just think he was a jerk. Oh, yeah, he's controlling. He's got all those rules, you know. So along the way, I start collecting a few legal problems. I just thought that's what people did, you know, drunk in public. Well, yeah, I mean, I get drunk. I want to go somewhere. And I remember telling this officer, like, I can't believe that every time you see me, you give me a ticket. And, you know, and I remember him because now it's changed and I get what he's saying. Is he said to me, I can't believe that every time I see you, I have to give you a ticket. And I was like, yeah, that's what I just said. And so, you know, so I got a lot of drunk in public. So, I got a lot of open containers. I thought that the rules don't apply to me. I can drink anywhere I want. And then, you know, and I would come up with these real a-hole excuses like, it's legal to do this in Vegas. And the cops would be like, yeah, you're not in Vegas. And I'm like, you know, buzzkill. You know, I never get scared and apologize. Maybe I would have gotten out of some. I never was like, I'm so sorry, I'll never do it again. I wouldn't do that. I never did that. I just lacked any humility, you know, to do that. Even if it would have benefited me, I just couldn't pull it off. I got DUIs. I don't know why I don't have a lot more, you know. So after I got rid of the last guy that I was with in my disease, I forgot, because, you know, I'm like completely out of my mind on alcohol. And I forgot that he was paying for everything. Like, I know, I really, like, I forgot. I walked out with a speech, you know, like, and I'm out of here. And, you know, and I had some cash because I always stole from him. But, like, you know, not enough, not like a lifetime's worth. And so, you know, now I'm like in my disease and I'm like, oh my God. But again, I won't go back. you know, I'm not going to say I'm wrong. I won't say I'm sorry. And I guess, you know, he finally was like just happy I was gone. He didn't even care, right? He's like, I hope she never comes back. But I started, you know, really bottoming out. The last few years of my disease, I mean, the mid-years were just a lot of, I don't remember. I can tell you that I went to a lot of happy hours, but it never ended happily, and I never left when everybody else left. I always meant to. You know, that's what I love about this fellowship. That's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous is that, you know, I used to just think that there was something really wrong with me. And I never talked about that with anybody. I just thought, you know, you're just kind of an evil, crazy person. And because, you know, the truth is that I did love my kids. And the truth is that I did want to give them a good life. But I also needed to drink. And so I had every intention. Like, I mean, I'm telling you a million times, I'm going to go. I'm going to enjoy the buffet. I'm going to eat the taquitos. And I'm going to have the $1 drink because I need to be part of that. And everybody else is leaving. And then, like, I'm at a bar called The Sewer. They don't have happy hour there. And, you know, and it's like 5 in the morning or it's 5, like, 2 days later, you know, and I'm on this binge. And then now I'm, like, coming home. And, you know, that's what I did over and over and over again. And, you know, at an early age, I remember that, you know, like when my parents or, I don't know, school officials or anybody in authority, they would ask me, like, why did you do that? And I realized, I stopped giving them the truth. The truthful answer was, because I wanted to. And that seemed to piss people off. And so I stopped saying that. But the truth is that I did do stuff just because I wanted to. And then eventually I did stuff because I needed to, but I thought I wanted to. But I could never make the second part fit. I could never stop and go home. And it's sad because my kids would come and get their lunch money. They'd come, you know, every bartender in Ventura knows my kids, not because my kids drink, you know. All of the locals that sit at the end of the bar stools and all the dive bars, you know, in any town in the USA, all of those guys in Ventura know my kids, give my kids school money, give my kids lunch money, because my kids knew those people because they'd have to go hunt me down, you know, and sometimes they'd find me and sometimes they wouldn't. And, you know, and I blame them. I tell my kid, you keep stealing my car. You might as well become my designated driver. You know what I mean? They didn't get off either. I blame them, and I really did a number on them. I eventually started getting more and more sick every day, and I was driven into just really criminal behavior. And I didn't come into recovery on a high note or on a happy note. I looked like I know that my picture, I look like Beetlejuice. Like, the real, I did. And it wasn't like I was trying to, it wasn't Halloween. That's just how I looked, you know? I was just sick and diseased. And I thought I looked hot, you know? But clearly the picture suggests otherwise. And I brought a lot of criminal activity into my mother's home because I was homeless and I was living in my car with a girlfriend, 2 dogs, and 3 cats. Oh, yeah. No, and there was nothing wrong with me. Don't you judge me. You know, that was my attitude. Yeah, I have a good family to go home to. I just can't follow the rules, so I don't go home to them. I'm living in the car. I don't know why my kids are embarrassed. They're like, remember when you pulled up and you had a couch on top of your Land Cruiser? And at the time, and I'm not talking for a day, for like a good month, because I was like, yeah, because when I get to where I'm going, I'm going to need somewhere to sit. I mean, I just didn't understand, like, why are you judging me? But this is just the decisions I make in my disease. It's just like it doesn't even, you know, I look back and I'm like, you know, but I was fine with what I was doing, but I really wasn't. And eventually my mom was like, you know, go ahead, please come home. Boy, that woman, you know. And so the police raided her home and I was arrested, and it was March of 2012. Now, my sobriety date is until December 4th of 2012, because again, I didn't go into jail and think, well, time to clean up. No, I went in and I made pruno and I hustled out my commissary for psych meds. And like, you know, that was my whole plan. I had a big resentment against God. So like every time the preacher came in, I was like, you know what? I'm sure he's violating my rights. I wasn't like coherent or smart enough to come up with what rights he was violating, but I knew my rights were being violated. So I was always complaining and, you know, the deputies hated me. They moved me around a lot. And, you know, eventually I'm locked up because I'm not suitable for population. And I'm locked up and I'm in a room by myself. And now, at that point, I had a clear enough mind. I heard God. And I have to tell you that my plan was never to share that with anyone. And for a while, I was like, oh my God, I'm like really crazy finally. Like, you know, and it was like kind of a relief. I thought, well, this is comforting, you know, because it's either God or I'm crazy. But either way, it feels okay to me. It was better than anything I'd been feeling up until that point. And God had a way of just kind of putting it into my mind, like, haven't you tried? Haven't you tried? Like, haven't you tried? Like, don't you? First of all, he asked me some questions he knew I'd give him the good answers to. He said, don't you, aren't you the smartest person in the world? And I was like, absolutely. You know, oh yeah, God, I totally am. I am the smartest person in the world. And this is just something that I actually believed, you know? And he was like, then why are you in jail? And I was like, and I was facing prison time. I was going to go to prison for a few years, many years, much more than I had planned for. They were real offended by they found my behaviors very objectionable. And so, you know, so I'm telling God, I'm like, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm just not lucky like other people. And he was like, you know, well, if you've tried everything, you know, why don't you give me a try? And I want to tell you, because I've met a lot of people who are like, oh, I'm not down with the God thing. And I'm just going to tell you that God kind of, because that's what I told him. I'm like, I'm really not into you. I'm going to have to be honest. You know, I didn't even go to God humbly or willingly. I like let him know what was wrong with him, right? I was like, I'm really not into you. And he's like, you've gone back to dealers that burned you, men who've cheated on you. Like, you've gone back to some real scoundrels in life, and you're not willing to give God a chance. And I was all, okay, if you're going to put it that way, you know, then I will, right? So, you know, so again, at this time, I think I'm crazy. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, yeah, God, I'm going to give, you know, what do I have to do? And he's like, nothing. You just have to, you know, trust me and have faith in me. And I remember I started crying because I was like, I don't know how. I have no idea how to do that. I said, I just don't know how. And he said, don't worry, I'll show you. All you have to do is be willing. You know, are you willing? And I said, you know, God, you know, look, like I had other options, right? I said, hey, God, if you can change this, if you can fix my life, I'm going to let people know that you did it. And I never intended on telling anybody about talking to God because I never thought he could fix my life. When I had that discussion with God, I didn't believe in him or have faith in him or any of his abilities. The relationship that I have with him now wasn't what I had with him that day, but it was a start. And I don't know, miraculously, after a year, against my lawyers, you know, he objected the whole time, by the way. I didn't get sent to prison. I got an 8-year prison sentence, a suspended sentence, and they gave me 5 years felony probation. And I remember that my lawyer said, you'll never make it. You really screwed up. You should have just taken the 4. It's a setup. And I was like, you know, screw you. You don't know anything. I've got God. You know? And I'm pretty sure that's how I said it. And so he was like, whatever, you know, and we didn't part ways shaking hands. I didn't thank him or anything, you know. And so I got out of jail on December 4th. I was supposed to go to rehab. And, you know, I had mixed feelings about that. I participated in a lot of treatment centers, and I've always cheated and lied and manipulated my way through. I've always, you know, I couldn't pull it off. That's what I'm saying. But I really wanted to. And I really wanted this God thing to come through for me, you know. But when I got home, it wasn't great. It was like, this is how I felt. I felt like everybody, and by everybody, I mean my family who loves me more than anything, those people, they just were looking at me like, oh my God, I hope she does it. And they looked at me with all this hope. And I'm going to tell you, that scared me because I know I can't do it. And every day I want to just tell them, you know what? I can't do it. You know, you're right. Here's the thing. I'm never going to pull this off. And God kept me sober because every day I would think, I would tell him, you know, come on, God, you know what I'm going to do. And he's just like, it's okay. It's okay. I 3 weeks later, I got into rehab. And I remember I met Barb, you know, my first friend in Tulare County, because I had moved to Ventura because I ran away from all my mess here. So they sentenced me back to Tulare County, and I thought that was hell. But I met Barb, and, you know, I remember, she probably doesn't, but I remember I was looking through this book, the AA, the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was like, hey, did you know? Because I was thinking, I was scared. I was like, I don't want to tell them that I'm really relying on God, you know? I don't want to offend them because I really got to complete this program because I'm not trying to do 8 years, right? So I told Barb, I'm all, hey, did you know that they're talking about God in this Book of Alcoholics Anonymous? And apparently Barb's been in the rooms for a few years. So this wasn't like a big shocking revelation to her. So anyway, she saw, oh yeah, you're going to hear a lot about God. I was like, oh cool. Because, you know, in my head, I'm like, oh good. Because again, I'm planning everything. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh good. It's going to fit in with my plans and my big ideas. You know, I'm going to be able to pull off this, complete my probation term, stay sober for 5 years, talk to God once in a while, and hit the beach again, you know, and hopefully I'll still look good enough to land a man. That's my big plan, you know? And, you know, God intervened and he would save me from myself. He would save me from myself over and over and over again. And I'm going to tell you that it's an absolute miracle that I'm sober. I mean, it's an absolute miracle that probably most of you are sober. I don't want to say all. I don't want to put it in your mouth. But I'm just saying it's a miracle because I can't do that. No matter how much I want it, no matter how much I love my kids, I can't pull that off. And I know that. And that's what would keep, that's what scared me. I'm not scared anymore. And I'm going to tell you how that happened. So 5 years ago, they were dating at the time. Teddy and Stephanie came and they would pick me up from New Visions. And I thought, oh, that's cool. You know, get out of the house, out of the residential treatment center, go to an outside meeting, you know. And I want to say that for anybody who's ever taken the time to work with me, and I just appreciate it. I probably didn't at the time, but I want you to know today I appreciate that. I really recognize how important that is and what a valuable gift you were giving me. And, you know, now I understand you were doing it so you could stay sober, but it's still, it's amazing. And I really do value that. And I valued them. They came and they picked me up. And I'd like to say that I lived happily ever after, but that's not how I roll. So, you know, I really thought they were onto something. I thought this 12-step program, this program of recovery with precise instructions, it sounds like, yeah, I'm in. And I was in for a while, you know, not all the way in, but I was in, you know, to the best of my ability, I was in. And I guess that was good enough for God because he kept me sober. And, you know, I eventually sponsor hopped, you know, because one of my problems with the sponsors I was having trouble with is that they really didn't want to understand what piece of crap my exes were. You know, they didn't have time for that. And I remember that was like, I thought, you know, I'm willing to do this fourth and eighth step everybody talks about, but when do we get to the part where I get to tell you what a piece of crap I was with 10 times, you know? And they didn't want to hear that, you know, I just didn't have it in me. It's just that thing that I kept running up against my whole life, which is that even when I want to participate, even when I want want to do what I'm supposed to do, I get in the way. My self-will just does not let it happen. And, you know, and it's a miracle that I stayed sober. Eventually, and it's been about a year, I reconnected with my original sponsor, and I rejoined my previous home group, which is Primary Purpose, on Thursday nights at 7 o'clock on Bridge Street. And I made sure I got the time right. But, yeah. And I met up with people. My sponsor takes me through this book line by line. And she's... What's wonderful is that, God forbid, something happens to her, somebody else from the group will step right in because I'm not living a program of her recovery. It's this. And, you know, I used to think simple meant easy, you know, and I've come to find out, oh, it might be a simple plan of recovery, but it's not easy. It's not easy. And the hardest part is just surrendering and but I will tell you that if you do that, you will develop this relationship with God and it will restore you. And here's the thing. I remember going to the Alano Club. I don't quote this book because there's so many people who do it better than me. But what I remember from the Alano Club is I'd read the promises on the wall and I think I want all that. I want all of it. And I don't care. I was willing to just, do it just so I could get that. So again, I didn't get into recovery because, oh God, she's a good person. No, I got it to see what I could get. That's just who I am. The amazing thing is that, you know, going through this process and reading this, I'm just going to say it. You know, many people told me to read the first 164 pages of this book. Okay? That doesn't work for me. Here's why. I flip through, I find the chapters that don't pertain to me, and I don't even understand what the hell I'm reading. And I give up. By the way, I lie to you and I tell you I read it. You know, because I can quote all the stuff that you guys start and close their meetings with. So that's my experience. It may not be everybody else's experience. That's my experience. My experience is that I was pretty sure most of that crap didn't apply to me. And I have had just the privilege of, oh my gosh, I mean, God comes into it. When I meet with my sponsor when I get to work with somebody, God just comes into this and he reveals this and he makes it like where I can understand it. Because let's face it, it's just, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I was all, what the hell are these people talking about? And I really understand. It was a relief to find out that the allergic reaction, you know, I can deal with allergies. I can live with that. You know, being sentenced to understanding that I have an allergy and my allergic reaction is that I can't stop even when I want to. And that even if I get stopped, my mental obsession is probably going to just take me right back out. Oh, and by the way, I'm not that great anyway. I really do need God to come into my life even when I'm not drinking because I get in the way and I mess everything up. You know, and the doctor's opinion, I was reading this with my sponsee and I said, you know, it says it right here. And if you only read the first 164 pages, you'd miss this. You know, part of your allergic reaction is that you start creating these problems that you can't solve. That's basically what it says in one part of it. Somebody else could quote it word for word. But when I heard that, I was like, oh, yeah, that's me. And I love when I hear the insanity is not doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. The insanity is that I do it, I know I'm screwed, and I do it anyway. That's the insanity of this disease. And this 12-step solution, it saves me from myself and from all of that. And, you know, I am living happily ever after. I am happily married. You know, I got married a year ago. My kids were shocked. You know, they're still shocked. They still check in with him. You know, that's God, because I don't do that. It turns out that even when I'm sober, I'm pretty selfish and I'm very self-serving and I don't play well with others. But God comes into my marriage and he fixes that for me. And that's what those promises, you know, that's what happens in my life. I'm on felony probation and I got a great job with the county. I never thought I'd have another job in my life. That's God. I cried. I went to New Visions and I told them, oh my God, they're going to run a background check. And she's like, yeah, what'd you think was going to happen? And I'm like, oh God, they're going to find out what I was like. You know, it's not like a couple of drug charges. I wish. I just look pure evil. But that's the side effect of what happens to me and my disease. I act like I'm an evil person. I do horrible things, and I got arrested for a lot of bad stuff. On paper, I don't look so good. But God comes in and he gets me a job doing something I love. I love going to work. I love making money, you know? I love having insurance. And that's God, you know? So anyway, I'm going to close. Thank you.